our next guest, very excited to welcome back Pete LaMage. He ran in the primary for the Republican nomination for that U.S. Senate seat. At one point called for Leora Levy to step aside. Pete, you knew a real conservative could win that nomination, huh?
Well, actually, well, thank you for having me, and it's good to hear from you guys. But, yeah, real conservative. What changed the primary? It was Trump's involvement into this primary, and that was, 72 hours before the primary. That changed everything. All the candidates for the primary elections that have been endorsed by Trump, pretty much they won the primaries. Now the question is, okay, what's going to happen with the general? Because if they win the general elections, that will tell you that the Republican Party pretty much is the Trump Party. But if they lose the general elections, that would show weakness if Trump decides to run again, in 2 years.
So looking at these polls, and I've talked to Leora Levy since these polls came out, and I saw a comment from Bob Stefanowski. Their internal polling says it's a lot closer. I find it shocking all these polls could be way off. What we're seeing is unaffiliated voters, pretty split on the candidates. In the case of men, Leora Levy leads Blumenthal 47-44. When it comes to women, yikes. That's where this thing starts to turn into a bit of a blowout. Not only is she not particularly well known amongst women, that part of this polling, we're looking at a 65-35. That's pretty significant. Pete, my thought is here, I'm looking at all of the other pieces of the polling where people talk about their major concerns, and they talk about the economy, they talk about inflation, they talk about high taxes. If abortion is not driving this entire thing, I would think the polls would be the opposite based on those major concerns and that the Republicans would be up by 20.
Look, I've been reading pretty much article after article that I think the Republicans, the candidates, they should choose a particular or a number of issues that they want to tackle and go after, rampant crimes that we have in our state, the economy, inflation, currency depreciation, illegal immigration. I mean, these are issues that I think they are going to have to do a better job in getting out there and educating the voters, for lack of a better word. Educating the voters that, look, you may disagree on abortion, and that is one social issue that we're discussing little too much. I think that there are other issues that the Republicans should hammer and go after, the failed liberal policies in our state and nationwide. And this is where Leora Levy would come in with a strong position on these issues that and challenges that are facing, which are federal issues, and she would be handling them if she were to go to the United States Senate. And that's kind of it's showing weakness at this point, and it's kind of disappointing because we had the momentum, and Blumenthal's approval rating is not the greatest.
Yeah,
he's not as likable as people think he is. Money-wise, he's in very good position. He's raised a ton of money. He keeps on raising money. But he's spending money. And the fact that he's spending money against Levy, that tells you that he's not as secure or as confident that he's going to win this hands down. And I think Leora is going to have to do a better job going after him and, be fearless when she, points out the major differences between, what she stands for and what Blumenthal has been doing for since 1977 when he first got elected, in a political office.
If you had won that primary and you were going head-to-head with Dick Blumenthal right now, what would you be focusing on? And do you think, again, I know that you are a pro-life candidate, a very conservative man. Do you feel like you would also be getting hammered on that? And again, I just feel like it has become the only thing anybody wants to talk about. And speaking of Mr. Blumenthal, he's out there every chance he gets. And what's he talking about? Guns and abortion. Those are the only two things he wants to talk about right now. What would your approach be to cut this guy down?
I think that when you identify the issues, the challenges that we have, and there are many of them. I think we just have to start pointing out these challenges and the root cause of these challenges, which are the liberal policies. I mean, you can go after this guy on everything that he has done with regard to the Federal Reserve, everything that he has done with regard to foreign policy, everything that he has done with regard to immigration. I mean, they have so many issues that they can tackle and go after him factually, pointing out what he has done or what he has failed to do, and try to deflect the conversation from the social issues. I wouldn't change my position. I would still remain pro-life. I'm a pro-lifer. Mm-hmm. I never changed my position. But the fact that they are afraid now to defend those positions, and, you know, they are changing, you know, to a certain extent the way they are expressing that. I mean, if I were Leroy Levy right now, and if I had a debate with Blumenthal and the abortion issue comes up, you know, you accept the fact that, look, I'm pro-life. But let's talk about the currency. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve. Let's talk about the foreign policy. Let's talk about Biden failure policies that you're implementing and supporting each and every one of them. Ask a question. Are the voters better today than they were 4 years ago? You know, we're somehow allowing the media and the Democrats to paint us as a group of people that cannot avoid talking about abortion, cannot avoid talking about Trump. I mean, these are things that should be in the past for us. Because whether we like it or not, Roe v. Wade is over. It's because of the 10th Amendment. It was remanded back to the states to handle it. We're not denying that our state is going to be pro-abortion. It's going to be whether we like it or not. Now what we're saying is that it shouldn't be a national matter. Let the states decide that. And then, you know, just go into the issues that we're facing. And I think that's where we're failing. And if we... you know, the polls are indicating that people are not, the voters are not identifying with the Republican candidates at this point, with the exception of Stefanowski, which I think is going to do well, and George Logan in the 5th Congressional District, he should do well as well. But, you know, the polls are not, you know, very encouraging for the Republicans this time.
We are talking to Pete LaMage. Pretty well-known candidate here in Connecticut. He's run for a number of offices. He was competing in the Connecticut primary against Blumenthal that eventually went to Leora Levy. You know, Pete, you said something in there that kind of got my brain jumping for a minute. You talked about, and I've been speaking a lot about it, what the perception of extremism. Some of the things like... right off the top, election fraud, right? We know there was an election fraud that Joe Biden was elected legitimately. He's got a 35% approval rating, so he's done a terrible job despite being a legitimate president. I think you and I have discussed the Democrats' idea for open borders. Well, there's not open borders because we wouldn't have a record number of stops at the border. What we do have, I think these are Democratic failures. These are their policies failing. Crime is not rampant and out of control. It's dropped, but we still feel unsafe, and we've seen rape and murder actually on the increase here in Connecticut. So like you said, for Republicans, you don't even have to manipulate the information because they've done a pretty bad job. The policies have not gotten the results that were promised by Democrats.
I actually agree with you. And when I said that we should be factual, that means that we should verify the facts before we make a statement. Every time you turn on the TV, there is a murder in Hartford. There is a murder in Bridgeport. There is a murder in Waterbury, New Haven, you name it. And we should point out that defunding the police is not a good idea. We should be for law and order. When there is crime, businesses are going to leave. Poverty is going to follow. And these are things that Republicans should fearlessly talk about and blame it on the Democrats because it is their failure. One of the things that I think in the primary should not have happened, it was for Trump to get involved in our state. And the reason why I say that is because there's a feeling in our state or there's a concern that the voters have about the previous administration, the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. I think he should have stayed out of it because now Leora and Bob and, you know, the rest of the candidates, they're going to have to defend that position. And to defend that position, they should be able to separate the persona from the policies. And if they have to defend the policies, they should probably do that. as an individual, you may disagree with him, but policy-wise, he was very good. Had he stayed out of this primary in our state, I think that our candidates would have been in a better position. But now that it is what it is, and they're going to have to deal with it, and they should proudly and fearlessly defend his policies, the previous administration policies.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, and to her credit, and I just had her on about a week ago, Leora Levy was saying, you know, Trump's not on the ballot. It's me. You got to get to know me. And it really is. This election cycle in particular, and you're right, Donald Trump, unfortunately, couldn't take a hint and exit right because it is. And it's not only here in Connecticut. But we're seeing in Arizona and in other, you know, normally very reliably Republican strongholds where you've got Senate candidates either down or within a point or two of the Democrat in places where that should never happen. And I think, like you said, it is. And listen, I understand, you know, look, if you're a Republican, there's a good chance that you are a Donald Trump supporter, or at worst, like you say, Pete, all the time, the policies were good. I know he was a little obnoxious in the way that he governed, but the policies were good. If he was just stepping aside and we could talk about policy again.
Look, if we were to analyze what happened before the primary with Trump being involved, you had a number of professional politicians, including Tom Scott and Dick Morris, and these people being involved for whatever reasons, encouraging actually Trump to endorse Leora Levy. From my point of view, I think, you know, that may haunt her back. She can deny the fact that Trump is not on the ticket, but the voters feel different, and so do I personally. Absolutely, so do I. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't support her and her policies and do anything I can to make sure she wins, but you cannot deny the fact that her campaign, our own party, if you will, or the advisors enticed her into getting the endorsement. And there's nothing wrong with getting the endorsement, but you cannot deny it now, because even people who would be supportive of her at this point would say, hold on a second, you pretty much won the primary because of the endorsement. And we don't deny that. And you have no reasons now to turn around and say, well, he's not in the ticket. His policies are. The media is not going to ignore what happened on January 6th, whether we like it or not. The media is not going to ignore that the attorney general in New York City, you know, is trying to, you know, get Trump. The media is not going to ignore the fact that he's, you know, resident in Florida was raided by the FBI, that he's being investigated. We're going to have to deal with this. But if they were able to handle properly the differences between him and the policies, I think they can still benefit from the policies. Just point out that, look, during the Trump administration, inflation was pretty much non-existent, was full employment. The economy was strong. Foreign policy, we were feared and respected. Right now, we're neither feared nor respected abroad. Nobody really fears the current president abroad. Now, these are things that they should be able to say, listen, we may disagree with certain things that he would have done or could have done otherwise. Let it go. But policy-wise, stick with the policies. Do not deny the fact that you benefited or she benefited at one point from his endorsement. And now she shouldn't run away from it and say, look, I benefited from it. He supported me. I support his policies. I'm going to stick with it. Let's talk about our state. Let's talk about the failed liberal policies of the current administration. Let's see what Dick Blumenthal has done for the past 35 years that he's been involved in politics. Let's see what Chris Murphy's doing. Let's see what Joanna Hayes is doing. Let's see what Lamont is doing. Let's go after these elected officials who are letting us down and try not to nationalize the race at this point, because we have to resolve the challenges that we have in our state, and let's deal with them instead of, running away from what is obvious that at one point, I would say almost all of us who are running for office would have loved to get his endorsement. But then you have to deal with the consequences of that endorsement eventually.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Here's my other concern, Pete, going forward for the GOP. You had a really good situation here where nationally could have won the House, probably could have won the Senate. You would have been able to stop Joe Biden dead in his tracks for the next 2 years, set yourself up for the 2024 election, because the way things are shaking out, we should expect a recession for 2023. And most experts are saying the recession should end by early 2024, which means that the economy after that recession will start to improve and improve and improve. And they'll have maybe 8 months till the election of an improving economy post-recession. And I feel like that's only setting the Democrats to win again in 2024.
Well, the Democrats know what they are doing. I disagree with what they are doing, but they know what they are doing. Look at the gas prices right now, for example, that they are artificially being driven down by tapping the reserves that we have for, you know, national emergency if need be. They are doing that, and right after the primary election, the November election, you're going to see the gas prices going up again because we're not producing. These are things that I think the Republicans should have the talking points together and make sure that each and every one of them, every single day that they speak somewhere, meet with people, just point out what's going on and how is it affecting us. Look at the inflation. It's at over 8%. That means that, you know, 8% of your, you know, the value of your money, it's pretty much evaporated, it's disappeared. We're losing money every single day because of this. These are things that, and when it comes to, as we said, the open borders and, you know, other issues that we're facing, I think that both Bob and Leora and all the candidates, but whether they are running for the House or Senate or governor or lieutenant governor, they should have these talking points every single day on the TV, on the radio, on the media, talking to the public, and remain concentrated on these things, because once we lose sight of what we're trying to tell the voters, what's going on in our state, and deal with issues that are pretty much settled, whether we like it or not, abortion is settled. It's bad. We're going to have to deal with that. The Supreme Court was clear on that. They are going to have to try to concentrate on other issues instead of just these social issues that are pretty much driving certain segment of the voting population away from us.
Yeah, exactly right. A lot of Band-Aid solutions by the Democrats, and I agree. I don't think the Republicans are really hammering the idea home, and I hate to blame the media, Pete, because I'm not a blame the media kind of guy, but you do make some solid points with that. They cannot stop talking about this one issue that is the law in Connecticut, and it would be very difficult to no longer make the law here. Pete Lamage, I, as always, appreciate your time. Would love to have you back on and get your perspective about the election before November 8th.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that. Anytime, okay?
Much appreciated. Peter Lamage, everybody, a fantastic conservative and a very good family man. Pete, again, thank you so much for joining us. Our next guest is Michael Oratade. He's the Green Party candidate for the 1st State Senate District, representing Hartford and Wethersfield. So seat currently is held by John Finferra, who is a Democrat. Michael, thank you for being here on WICC.
Thank you for having me. And can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. You sound fantastic. And just so you know, I live in the first.
Awesome.
Yes, sir.
So I got to win you over.
Yeah, let's do this. I've been reading up about you a whole bunch. I've really, this whole week, we've really kind of, at least I have, I've been trying to get more into alternate candidates. Green Party, we spent a lot of time with the Independent Party candidates, because I hear from everybody, Michael, and I don't know, I mean, I'm assuming this is why you're a Green Party guy. I'm hearing from people all the time, you know, it's the lesser of two evils, it's two choices, and we need more choice, and we need more really good candidates. I don't want to get too crazy into your background in this question. What got you to decide, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to run?
So it's a medley of things that really, like, brought me to this point. I can say, you know, it started with activism. You know, when George Floyd was murdered by police out in Minneapolis, I kind of got like a spiritual calling to stand up and say something. And that's what I did. I led marches all over Connecticut, because what a lot of people don't know is that, you know, people of color die at the hands of police in Connecticut, too. Mm-hmm. There's a laundry list of individuals who lost their lives at the hands of police during mental health crises and, you know, just wrongfully murdered. So I spoke out, and we ended up getting the police accountability bill passed together with the community. We worked hard to get that done. And during that process, excuse me, we ended up for me, you know, knowing all of the issues, being an African American, you know, being black, I already live this experience. I live, you know, being worried about the police following me. I lived in a food desert for a long time. So all of these issues just kind of opened up to me as issues that needed to be solved. And so I started to, you know, protest and bring attention to a lot of the issues that were affecting black and brown communities. And, you know, it got to the point where I just felt like I'm tired of begging individuals for solutions that have been laid out already. I'm tired of begging for them to apply these solutions. I need to be the change maker instead of asking for people to make change when it's clear that they have the ability to, but what do they want to do it, you know?
Right.
And it's time for us to get individuals who are capable of, you know, applying solutions and seats of power and having the means to really to make change.
So you really became an activist with the murder of George Floyd. I saw where you had said when the Trayvon Martin thing happened is when you wished that you had. And I've often cited this as the moment in America. And initially I was like, George Zimmerman did the right thing. It took me about 6 months before I realized exactly what was going on. And I realized the bigger issue here was this country was totally splitting in half to where we couldn't even agree on murder being wrong anymore. When you look at all the other issues that divide us in this country, it's like murder? Really? We can't agree right. That murder is wrong, and especially, and I know people are so crazy pro-police, we should be pro-police when they deserve it, right? I talked earlier about, you know, their response to all the riots in 2020, which a lot of those started out as protests about police brutality, and the police's response, as you know, Michael, was to brutalize the protesters. Interesting way to respond, isn't it?
Right. And what a lot of people don't know is that, like, any protest that broke out into riots were really the minority of protests. So not a lot of protests ended up breaking out into violence. I remember at a time when that rhetoric was being put out there, like a good 98% of the protests were peaceful. And even, you know, as a leader of protests in Connecticut, it was one of the big things for me to let people know, like, we are in Connecticut. We do live in a state and we love our home. We're going to make sure that we keep it peaceful out here. You know, people are already spewing that negative rhetoric to say that, you know, Black Lives Matter is violent. And in reality, you know, it wasn't. And this goes back to, you know, Martin Luther King days. You know, one protest that erupts in violence because of the response from police does not equal a non-peaceful response. You know, we're not violent, you know.
We're talking to Michael Orotade. He is the Green Party candidate in the First State Senate District, which also happens to be my district. So I'm super, super excited to be talking to you, Michael. You know, one of the things I hear from the All Lives Matter crowd is that more white people are killed by cops than black people. And to that, I'm like, that's your argument? Your argument
Thanks
is
me.
This is such a dumb argument. The cops shouldn't be killing anybody who's unarmed, right, black or white. And again, exactly, we know, and this is where they conveniently don't want to talk about percentages or statistics. You know, obviously the chances of a black man being killed by police is exponentially higher than it is for a white person.
And the stark difference in that is that the population is a lot smaller. So that's, you know, and we know why that is. It's because our neighborhoods are policed more, you know, stringently,
right,
than whiter neighborhoods. And that's the reason why that happens, even though there are white people that who do die at the hands of police. It just doesn't happen as often, despite the large difference between the number of our populations. And, you know, we really need to start tackling these disparities. And what a lot of people don't know is that a lot of these issues that are affecting black and brown communities are wholly intersectional. You know, there's a lack of funding in our education. There's a lack of access to quality foods. There's just a lot of economic, socioeconomic issues that are harming the people. And what happens is when all these issues like compound on top of each other, it creates this. And I don't mean to call it perfect, but this perfect concoction of just disparity. And what you see is what we have in many black and brown communities all over America. And what people don't really seem to understand is that were we to solve, let's say, two or three of these problems, then we would start alleviating a lot of the issues and start making it a lot easier for black and brown people to survive and not resort to crime or not have the many chronic illnesses that we experience. There's so many ways for us to solve these problems, and I have a boatload of solutions that I'm ready to bring to the Senate floor once I'm elected. I have a ton, man. My list of goals is very long and strong, and I plan to make sure that I get it done once I'm in office.
My guest this hour is Michael Ortade. He is the Green Party candidate for the State Senate District 1. Michael, am I saying your last name right?
Yeah, that's fine. You're saying it pretty good, man. I appreciate you.
Yeah, man. I'm trying. All right. So you are a teacher, like I said, and I've been pumping this idea for a while, is the idea that, you know, an educated society, a lot of your problems get solved by then. I think back to when Obama was talking about ISIS, and he said, you know, these are people who just need opportunity, and people sort of mocked him for it. And I remember thinking, well, yeah, I mean, if these guys had something better going on, they probably wouldn't be involved in terrorism. And I think the same applies, right? If people are educated and that they're able to make a living for themselves, it makes things a lot easier. And you see a reduction in crime and homelessness and all the things that we're trying to solve.
Exactly. You know, being an educator and being an African-American, I've seen just how complicated it can be. Around education, you know, our schools are run off of property taxes. And as you know, places like Hartford are predominantly not owned by the individuals that live there. Mm-hmm. So we run into this issue where we have a lot of properties there where individuals are not paying their taxes. We have a lot of state owned and city owned property that is, of course, exempt from taxes. And if we don't have things like pilot that are fully funded, then we have a bunch of money that's missing from the schools. And even if you look at it right now, we have a bunch of kids who do not have a teacher right now in Hartford, because Hartford has a 90 teacher shortage. And so they're not only missing out on a quality education, they're missing out on individuals who can provide a quality education. And that is because of the immense disparities that exist. A big thing that I'm pushing for right now for the entire state of Connecticut is universal early childhood education. I started teaching as a early childhood educator. I started teaching at pre-K. And I can tell you right now, the students that I have, because I'm now at elementary school where I'm the building substitute teacher for the school, the students that I had, they are so much more, and I'm assuming a lot of the students that had experience that my students had preschool, pre-K, they have a very strong social understanding. They have a very strong understanding of complex concepts because they had an experience that a lot of children don't. And I can see the stark difference from, you know, from kids that I grew up with or kids that are from the inner city that don't have their ABCs down. They don't have all their colors down. They're not speaking at a higher level because they weren't able to get a speech pathologist in pre-kindergarten. So these are the things that are provided once we give these children the tools to succeed. We give them the ability to have mental health supports. We give them the ability to have speech pathology. And if they have they're struggling with like a lisp or something, they get the chance to strengthen their language and their vocabulary. These are all the things that are usually provided with a good early childhood center. And that's what I want for people to have. you know, across the state. Everybody deserves to have a quality education. You would think that it would be something that is written into our Constitution, but, you know, it isn't. And, you know, hopefully one day we realize how important education is and that controlling the people isn't as important, but making sure that the people have the liberties that this country promised them, then we should be able to provide that quality education across the board.
Michael Oratade is the Green Party candidate for the 1st State District 1, State Senate District 1. The website, by the way, mikeforct.org. Michael, we haven't mentioned your website at all, and we definitely need to because I want people to go and I want them to check it out. Education, I know, is very important to you. Housing is a serious issue. I think, what did I see? 114 towns and municipalities still haven't submitted their affordable housing plan at this point. It was due in June.
And even with the affordable housing, who is the affordable housing really for when affordable housing is coming at the cost of $1,500 a month for one bedroom, $2,500 a month for a multiple bedroom? You know, we really have to start thinking about the because what happens is we use these terms that we coin things, certain things, and then they kind of lose their power. The words lose those power, the power that they should have. You know, affordable housing isn't really affordable. And I'm starting to think that we need to start thinking about transitional housing. We need to start thinking about because we have so many people who are reliant on programs like Section 8.
Yep.
You know, and people and, you know, the conservatives will tear it apart. They hate it. They hate concepts that are like Social Security. They hate things like social safety nets. They hate these things. And in my opinion, if you truly hate these things, then we need to be working on solutions so that we don't need to be using a lot of our government spending on a lot of these programs. If you don't want these programs to exist, then we need to be picking people up, not removing them and leaving them to suffer. It doesn't really make any logical sense for us to take those kinds of actions. Instead, we need to establish more transitional housing. It's a big thing for me. I think the state should start creating more transitional housing. And we're not talking about project housing. We're talking about housing where people pay a specific rate and they don't have to pay beyond that rate, whether they make more money or not. We need to have it so that it's a fixed, it goes off of their income. It's fixed, a fixed price instead of a fixed income. It's a fixed price, and that they pay that. And that they also get the tools for financial literacy. And, you know, conservatives will even hate this, too, because they feel like they're hand-holding. But if you, again, we go back to education. If you did not provide the proper education for a person to know how to be financially literate, and then you're mad that they are suffering and living off the system because they did not get the tools to progress in society, then how can you be mad that they are getting the tools now and you're giving it to them late? So this is for everyone that if we don't empower them through education, then this is for everyone who didn't have that opportunity. We can give them transitional housing so that we give them the financial literacy, the tools for success, so that they can be homeowners. And now their property tax can go towards the education that we're you know, it's all intersectional. It's where it's lacking. If we really start taking an intersectional approach to a lot of our legislation, then we can start to alleviate a lot of the issues that are occurring.
If you're looking at housing numbers, by the way, millennials don't want to live in the suburbs. These millennials prefer city living, not having to use the car to take the bus to get where they need to get. And obviously our cities, you mentioned Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, amongst the other ones, are not necessarily doing that great. And I hate to say this, but could these young millennials trying to get into the city be the push that we need to finally get legislators to look at the cities and improve the cities?
In order for that to happen, the legislators are going to really need to be on top of the developers. It's the developers that come in and they buy property and then they put the prices really high and they want to just gauge it. Because I know that there's a company that's moving out of Hartford. I can't speak to what their name is, but I know that they are in the process of leaving Hartford, actually, because they are upset that their apartments aren't being rented at the rate that they wanted them to be rented. And it's, of course, due to wealth inequality. People aren't able to afford a $2,000 one-bedroom, 690-foot square foot apartment. Nobody even wants that. No one would want that. So, yes, no one is going to rent that. And if we really start to get on top of the developers in ways that don't impede constitutional law, of course, then we can start to make the necessary moves to make sure that there is space for people to live and that it's affordable, truly affordable, and that people have an opportunity to elevate out of it when they're ready to. Because a lot of people, a lot of millennials, as a millennial, I can speak to this, a lot of millennials don't want to own a home because they literally cannot afford to own a home. It's not something that is feasible. And, of course, bikeable cities are an appeal. If we get more bikeable cities, more the ability to kind of move around the town without without driving, it saves us money. So millennials think in a way that cost cuts, because this is the way that we have had to live. We had to live working 2 to 3 jobs in order to survive. We don't want to do that anymore. We want to be able to live and move around easier. And that would probably be the easiest way for us to do it. And of course, city living is cool. Everybody wants to live in a cool city like Hartford, you know?
Yeah, exactly. We are talking to Michael Ortade, the Green Party candidate for State Senate District 1. Now, Michael, I'm trying to like nail the name and I keep messing it up. I've gotten
it's
into
okay.
my own head.
Good.
Yeah.
Ortade.
MikeForCT.org is his website. You could find out how he feels about a lot of these topics. There's also a link there for people who would like to volunteer. Michael, when I first heard about white privilege, and you're talking to a 47-year-old white man who lives in the suburbs of Hartford, I was like, what? White privilege? Ridiculous. And then people explained what it was, and I was like, oh, yeah, I totally have that. I totally get it. And when I hear systemic racism in this country, I'm a real estate agent part-time in my other activities. Education loans, business loans, student loans, home loans. Systemic racism certainly does exist. We've seen it play out in all of these avenues I've just mentioned. And even there's companies now, Wells Fargo or Bank of America, I know one of them is offering really low rates to African Americans as a way of apologizing for years of discriminatory practices. So it is a very real thing, as is the wealth gap between whites and blacks. So when people say stuff, Mike, like, you guys got to pull yourself up in the bootstraps, what a ridiculous and ignorant thing to say.
It is a very ignorant thing. And, you know, like you're saying, there's so much confusion about how race relations work in any nation or kingdom. If something was abolished 70 years ago and you expect it to be all gone and not have already seeped its deep, sharp teeth into everything that we stand on, then you are not thinking clearly. Nations have existed for hundreds of years and have had to battle with these types of issues when there's race relations, whether individuals lived in the mountains and individuals lived on flat lands. They had a different perspective of those people. There were always these types of tensions throughout history. So for us to completely ignore the fact that these issues existed here in some of the worst instances of these issues, we're talking about subjugation, whippings, hangings, killings, murders, these things that were happening when people thought that individuals who were a darker complexion were lesser, mm-hmm. that you think that that's just going to go away because we wrote it down on a piece of paper and said it's done, then you are largely misguided on anything historical. And it proves that education is a problem even in your wealthy neighborhoods. So we have to start thinking a little bit more critically, you know, critically about these issues, because they're really affecting people. And the fact is that if all of these corporations are acknowledging the fact that they had their hands in this and that they need to make it right, and for you to still sit here and say, you know, oh, they're giving them a handout, or they're giving them a leg up on me. No, they're not giving them a leg up on you. Your ancestors and the individuals who came before you, and maybe individuals that are not even related to you, because you might have been a person from Ireland or some, you know, a place where mm-hmm. individuals who came here and they faced systemic challenges as well, they got theirs and they were able to progress throughout society. Because there are individuals who are not black who suffer the issues that we had to suffer through, and maybe they're not at the same level, but that is the way that they are intersectional. They have an intersection at some in some shape or form. And I would argue that some white people are more oppressed by the simple fact that they are a product of white supremacy, that they uphold the values of white supremacy, misogyny, and all of these isms, that they are also negatively impacting themselves mentally. They're negatively impacting their entire lifestyles. Because if we were to hoist up everyone and take care of everyone's issues, then you would have a better life. And it's that simple. If we have more taxes, if we have more people, tax-paying people, then you would benefit. You know, yep. All of us would benefit. We would be less people in prison, then less of your tax dollars would be going towards keeping the prisons open. And that's what people don't seem to understand about a lot of these issues. We need to be making sure that individuals from communities of color have mental health services to curb the need for law enforcement. We need to make sure that our education system is wholly funded so that individuals have an actual shot at life. And we need to make sure that individuals have no interest home loans, the same type of home loans that white people got at the turn of the century when the Great Depression happened. We need to make sure, because black people were completely left out of that equation. Black and brown people.
G.I. Bill as well, right? G.I. Bill cut out of the G.I. Bill after World War II. That happened.
And that's after fighting the war as well. So individuals of color have long since been at the back burner of everything. And then the minute that we get a little bit of justice, a little sprinkle of breadcrumbs of peace and some stability, we're told that we're getting an unfair advantage. And that's because, for whatever reason, the true history of this nation is not being taught. Real conversations centered around race and race relations are not being had, and people are sweeping it under the rug. I want people to know that if you sweep a problem under the rug, it does not have a solution. If we don't talk about an argument that we had, it's still festering in the back of our mind. Why would racism disappear if all we did was say racism is done? We didn't even talk about it. We didn't even have the complex conversation to say why it was wrong, what we did. We have not done the work. So yes, we're going to have to suffer another 300, 400, 500 years of having these uncomfortable conversations if you don't start making the change now. If we don't start providing entrepreneurship opportunities for those penalized by cannabis prohibition, for individuals who are suffering in these neighborhoods from food deserts, then we are not going to get over this hill. So you can keep listening to us complain about it until the problems are solved. And if you don't want to hear about us complaining about these problems, then solve them.
Michael, I'm just going to, because I'm sure there's people sitting here right now, and I'm just going to drop a short history lesson on them. 1865, right? The Civil War ends, 1863, Emancipation Proclamation. But then that ushered in Reconstruction, where there were vagrancy laws for the newly freed slaves who didn't have jobs or places to live, were being thrown in jail and then being sold on the chain gang back to the plantations they had just been freed from. And when we finally stopped that from happening, Jim Crow came along. And then after Jim Crow, 103 years after the Civil War, came the Civil Rights Movement. 103 years later. That's an insane thought. And then Nixon brought in the war on crime. Reagan brought mm-hmm. in the war on drugs. And right? White people are like, how come you guys can't get it together? Oh, wow. Not like you haven't been facing a million obstacles along the way.
Exactly. And you know what? It's time for us to start acknowledging, and it's time for individuals who are not of color, who exist in these little redlined, and you didn't even get into redlining, because a lot of neighborhoods are also still redlined to this day, and redlining is technically illegal. But if you really look at your neighborhoods, you will see that they still exist. The red line still exists. So we need to start making sure that these issues start getting resolved. And this is why my generation is tired, and we have the same individuals who were working within the system that are holding offices now, that were working in the system when there was still racism, there were still racist practices happening within the system. We're talking Reaganomics, we're talking about the Nixon era, we're talking about all of these things. We have these people who are still around in office right now making laws for you. You got a 30-year incumbent right now who's my opponent, and I won't badmouth him, but we have him who's sitting in office for 30 years now, and a lot of the issues that are happening in neighborhoods like mine that are happening all over the country are not being changed. All over the state that are not being changed, no one is fighting for it until it hits the fan. Excuse my language, but until it hits the fan, no one wants to talk about it. You know?
Mm-hmm. MikeForCT.org is his website. Michael Ortade is the Green Party candidate for the State Senate District 1. Michael, looking at your Facebook page and your website, I see you're out there, you're hitting the streets. What kind of feedback are you getting right now out on the campaign trail?
So we do have a lot of people who are stark Democrats. We have a lot of people who are staunch Republicans and things like that. But we do have a very vocal majority that is saying that they are tired of the two-party system, that they don't vote for democracy at all, and that they are literally itching for a different, you know, from something new. And I think that, you know, if more people know about me, I would get a lot more support. I do have a lot of support just from off of the individuals that I have run into and I've had conversations with. And oddly enough, even some Republicans. Republicans have, you know, been pretty vocal about their support, you know, when it came to me because of my views when it comes to liberty and having the freedom to really have the ability to do anything for yourself. And, you know, they might not see eye to eye with me on like civil rights issues and things because they, again, don't have the education around that issue. And as far as the Democrats go, they're just fearful that if they bow out and, you know, try to vote someone in, that they feel as though they might be giving votes to the Republicans. And it's a real fear, which is why Ned Lamont has vowed to support ranked choice voting. But individuals can lose that fear. It's time for us to not be afraid of voting for individuals that really represent our values instead of voting across the party line, because that is a problematic approach to our system. If you feel as though you can only vote by the party, whether or not you support that person's ideals, you're probably going to end up voting for them. And that's not how a democracy should be ran. You don't want to vote someone in that's not going to represent what you believe in. And hopefully, you know, this election goes well and we can continue to move in a direction where people feel comfortable voting for who they truly believe in instead of voting out of fear. Because that's where we are.
Michael, in 2018, I voted for Oz Griebel because he was the only one of the three gubernatorial candidates that knew what he was talking about and had any sort of experience. And I decided I didn't care what the little letter in parentheses after his name was. I thought, boy, I have no idea what these other two guys are going to do. I didn't even know if they know how to do the job. It just seemed to me like I had to vote with the guy that had any sort of experience. We've been talking a lot about that idea too this week, Michael, that, you know, a vote for a Green Party candidate or a Libertarian candidate or for an independent is going to hurt a Democrat or hurt a Republican, depending on where you are. Too bad. Too bad for the Democrats. Too bad for the Republicans. Run better candidates. Solve our problems. And things will go a lot easier for you. In the meantime, we need more choices. We need better candidates. And Michael, I got to tell you, I'm glad you're running. I'm going to try to, if you got an event coming up in the area, I'm going to definitely try to come up there and meet you and check you out and see what you're all about. But I don't vote by party. I vote by person, and I vote by people who I think are going to be effective. And Michael, I really appreciate your time. Michael Ortadé, again, the Green Party candidate for the State Senate District 1. His website is mike4ct.org. Michael, I appreciate it. I look forward to coming out and meeting you soon enough.
All right. Give me a call anytime, all right?
You bet. And good luck November 8th.
Thank you.
You're welcome.